You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours, but now at 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats. If you're new to the show, for the next hour, we'll be passing judgment on the latest cinema releases, working out which deserve a place amongst the great and the good, and which should hang their head and shuffle their feet in shame. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Kevin Hilton.
Hello.
Gavin Midgley.
Hello.
And Mark Livesich.
Howdy.
Today's show is hungry for revenge, whether by fists, dollars or a silver bullet. Only God Forgives finds Ryan Gosling trying to lose himself in the neon hell of Backstreet Bangkok before a double murder pulls him into the path of a policeman who sees himself as an avenging angel. The old reliable of the buddy cops gets genre, gets a makeover and two guns, with Denzel Washington's DEA agent and Mark Wahlberg's Navy intelligence officer as a reluctant double act, taking on an unforgiving Mexican drug cartel. And The Lone Ranger stars Armie Hammer as the masked man, eager to deliver justice to the outlaws who killed his brother, aided and abetted by Johnny Depp's mysterious Native American, Tonto. Plus, as a complete change of pace, we talk to the young producers behind Ramajulan, an Indian dramatic feature that has just finished shooting in Cambridge. And, with just about a month to go, we take our first look at this year's Cambridge Film Festival, talking to those behind the festival's many and varied outdoor screenings that have come to be a signature of the late Cambridge summer. That's all to come, but we begin the show by wanting to fight.
Ask him why he killed my brother.
Did you get the guy that did it?
It's a little more complicated than that, mother.
He hasn't told you, has he? There was someone else involved. Some cop.
You can't go around killing cops anymore.
Wanna fight? I'm just here for him.
But that's not what she said.
What did she say?
She said to kill them all.
We'll put out the hit.
It pains me to say this to you. He's a very dangerous boy.
When he released Drive back in 2011, Danish director Nicolas Winding Refn was following in the footsteps of many European directors by making his American debut with a very American genre, in this case the noir crime movie, and then polishing the pulp into art. Refn's new film, Only God Forgives, finds him making a similar play, with a box office friendly idea of a crime film starring heartthrob Ryan Gosling turned instead into a slow-mo descent into an ultra-violet Oedipal hell. As in Drive, Gosling is an almost wordless hero, playing Julian, one of two brothers running a Bangkok boxing club. Away from the ring, Julian silently keeps himself to himself, but his brother has an appetite for violence that leads to the brutal murder of a teenage prostitute. When in turn he is murdered at the request of the mysterious police inspector Chang, Julian lets it pass, wary to start onto a spiralling path of revenge. But then his mother, played by a steely Kristen Scott Thomas, unexpectedly arrives, determined that blood should answer for blood. Kevin, those viewers, and there were many, that were alienated by Drive's slow and steady pace are going to be even more bemused by the glacial speed of Only God Forgives. Did you find Refn's descent into hell compelling?
I think it was definitely compelling, and it is very sort of stylistic. And you're right, those who liked Drive will probably enjoy this, and those who didn't certainly won't like this at all. The two films are actually very similar, which is a criticism that I know it's sort of got, and probably quite fairly. There are times when it seems the Ryan Gosling character has simply been picked up and displaced into Thailand. It's sort of an alternate version of Drive in some ways. But I did like it, and say visually it's excellent, but I don't know if there's enough really going on. I don't know if there's enough really going on after Drive to justify its purpose of making it. But it might have been better as a first film as opposed to, and then followed by Drive rather than the other way around.
It's interesting that, Mark, Drive's very much, I mean, it was an art film by the standards that we expect from American noir thrillers, compared to something like Two Guns that we'll be discussing later. But by Refn standards, it was fairly talkative. This is a retreat, not a retreat, it's a deliberate step back into the style he had in Valhalla Rising and films like that, where where visuals took a precedent over dialogue and themes took a precedent over plot. There are certainly moments here, and we'll discuss those later, but is there enough going on to warrant the strength of those moments, to warrant the praise it's got? In terms of plot, I mean, rather than themes, is there enough plot, or is it just...
It does seem to be an argument that we keep coming back to with films. The discussion came up around The Master last year of, is a film with a thin layer of plot enough to sustain? Only God Forgives is only, I think it's not even 90 minutes. So there's not a huge amount of time to sustain over. I think you have to take it very much as a mood piece, as an ambient piece, rather than as a plot-driven exercise. It's giving a feeling of an almost alternate universe Bangkok. It won't certainly be doing much for the Bangkok Tourist Board, but certainly in terms of the emotional gut response it can evoke, it's very powerful. I don't know there's a huge amount that's original about it, but I think the way in which it's composed is very artful, and for me, it's something I would see myself revisiting quite happily. Well, not quite happily, but I would certainly come back to it in the future. I found it very powerful.
Gavin, again, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I expected to, not being the world's biggest fan of Drive, or indeed Valhalla Rising, or indeed Bronson, or many of his previous films, actually. I enjoyed it more than most of his previous films. But it worried me that... It depressed me, actually, that it was being... It felt like a magpie art film. It felt like every bit that was good was a bit that came from somewhere else. We have these long, dreamlike camera tracks down these red corridors in the hotel where he goes to meet his prostitute girlfriend, that Ryan Gosling's character, or the boxing club. They just feel like Kubrick light. And we have Chang, this fantastically deadly Thai policeman who then goes home to his child, who plays with her dolls and works her confrontations out with her dolls, and then goes off to sing. He then goes off to sing karaoke to his police officers, which again felt like Blue Velvet to me. The unexpected soft side or sentimental side to a monster. I just kept feeling I'd seen it this all before.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Kubrick, and that name immediately flashed in my mind during several sequences. That it's quite sort of hallucinatory, dreamlike imagery. I think, as Mark said, it's a mood piece, and it feels like, and Kubrick's style, the Kubrickian style, if I can use that word, is very appropriate to that. I mean, think to things like The Shining, obviously very moody, very dreamlike. The very static camera work involved, actually. I mean, I mentioned to you once that it felt almost like an adaptation of a graphic novel, literally transposed to the cinema screen, because there are so many static shots and with very little movement going on. And Kubrick would do similar sort of tricks like that, but usually in service of more interesting material, whereas this, to me, did feel a little hollow, as you've already said. There's not much perhaps going on behind the posturing, behind the panels, the artwork that we're sort of seeing, and the dialogue is so sparse. It yeah,
it's perfunctionary, really. It's just to get us from A to B with the
yeah,
exception
and it
of
works,
military
and
scenes.
Again, you could see that kind of works in the favour of a graphic novel, which this does. You know, that's the sort of sense that came to me as I was watching it.
Though, to be fair, a lot of the editing that's used and the way the scenes are broken up in a non-linear style wouldn't have worked in a graphic novel. I don't want to make it sound like it's a comic strip film
not,
in that style.
Not
it isn't.
At all. No.
Not in terms of how the story's told, just in terms of the framing and how he places the composition. I've said before, Mark, that this felt like a sort of primary version of Brian De Palma in the way that it the simplicity of certainly the Freudian aspect that it plays was it takes this Oedipus Oedipus story and does the usual things with it we've seen a thousand times before, to even to the extent of what Ryan Gosling does with his mother at the end. That all felt very traditional, rather staid and not stayed, it just felt overdone. I'm thinking in particular the scene where his mother, Kristen Scott Thomas, when she arrives and he hasn't met her yet, Ryan Gosling's character doesn't know she's there, Julian, and when he does find her, she's perched on the end of her bed, on the end of his bed rather. Now that's an interesting image, and that gets across in and of itself the fact that there might be a relationship, a perverse relationship between the two of them, but she's also wearing heavy makeup. And she also touches him in ways that goes on to touch him in ways that you wouldn't expect a mother to touch a son. And the dialogue, first thing she says to him is, "Did you miss me?" Again, everything felt like it was underlining this rather uninteresting point. It felt like he didn't... I can't get away from the fact it felt like an art film that had been made from a textbook on how to make art films. That's my problem here, I think. But as a strongest supporter of the film...
Yeah, I you seem to be making the argument that De Palma is to Hitchcock as Refn is to Kubrick.
Yes.
I would go with that to a certain extent, but I don't think that devalues De Palma. I would similarly argue that it doesn't devalue Refn in this context. I think, you know, the students of that particular school can still be valuable in their own way without necessarily being as original as the instigator of that particular movement. Some of the dialogue that Kristen Scott Thomas gets, she probably gets more dialogue than just about any other character, and some of that is deliciously unpleasant, particularly in the dinner scene where she's there with Gosling and his partner. So there are elements where it's just varied up a little bit and gets away from some of those themes being very broad. But again, I think because it's an ambient piece, because it's that sense of mood rather than that sense of plot, I think it's trying to keep those things simple. In the time it's got, it's not trying to deeply explore these Oedipal leanings or anything else. It's trying to keep itself abstracted from the whole piece.
Isn't that just a way of, in the end, not having to reach any conclusions or say anything really that interesting? In the end, it's not saying anything particularly interesting. It's visually interesting. It's compelling in certain scenes.
That appears to be making the argument that every piece of art has to say something interesting.
I think it does if it's going to film every character in slow motion.
This is not an intellectual response. It's an emotional response. I can't get away from hearing Noah Taylor in Submarine, an atavistic response. it's very much from the soul rather than from the head, in that sense. And I think on those terms it works. For those that prefer their cinema from the head, at least in part, as well as from the soul, I don't think they get much
from it. I like to feel the head's engaged. I don't mind it being the rest of it being as drifting as it is. I don't mind that. I just feel there's nothing behind it. But Kevin, to end with you, I think everybody's defending the film, and I'm defending it to a certain level, but I think I can't get away from how easily it slips into self-parody. Maybe I wasn't in the right frame of mind, but the fact that, as I just mentioned, everybody's filmed in a form of slow motion or it's under crank, whenever Chang, this type, which is a fantastic performance, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the actor's name, unfortunately, but this sort of middle-aged police inspector who comes in and slaughters with his machete those he thinks are guilty, but he's undercranked all the time. He's slowed down. In the end, I just kept thinking of Godzilla, not because that's how you make your movie monsters look hefty and dangerous. You undercrank the footage, and then I began to think of Miss Havisham in Rebecca, and the fact is it's Rebecca in the fact that she's always there and you never see her move, she just sort of is always hanging around. The fact that I was beginning to think of these things showed how quickly it was slipping into self-parody for me. Does it risk that too much? I mean, is that a consequence of not really having anything to say?
it is almost sort of parody. I think that's the director's sort of interest, though, isn't it? What's weird is that his interests seem to sort of be sort of schlocky B-movies, which is why he sort of produced the Maniac remake sort of recently. And I think he's interested in doing a Maniac Cop remake. But his films seem to... So it seems odd that when he goes to put his hands on a movie, it is sort of comes from a Kubrick sort of sensibility. But I think that is somewhere in the mix. I think it is probably sort of schlock, but mixed with a Kubrick sort of lens,
well,
which is interesting.
The style, I think it's because that's the content is pulp. The Freudian aspect of this is pulp. It's not particularly incisive. It's not particularly his idea of linking sex and violence, which he's spoken about in interviews, and the way that and the fist is a penetrating weapon. That's all sixth form poetry Freudism. That's pretty dull. But it's also the Freudism that you get in some comic books, and I think he's sort of marrying that simplicity to the fact that his visuals are fantastic. He does have this rich array, but he's drawing again. He seems to be bringing these two things together. In a way that sort of Tarantino does, but Tarantino then does something else with it. I think that's my problem with it, Mark, to finish up. I'll come back to you to defend it, because everybody's liked it, I've liked it, but you've seen a value in it that the rest of us haven't.
I suppose the one other thing I would say is, I maybe slightly disagree with Kevin, that I actually feel it's very different from Drive. I feel Ryan Gosling's character is very different from Drive. I couldn't honestly recommend it to anyone in good conscience, but if you like it, come and talk to me, because I got a lot from it, even though it wasn't intellectually driven.
It's worth pointing out, if anybody's not has read the reviews about it being ultra violent, it's ultra violent in terms of, it's horribly violent, but most of it is unseen. There's one particularly unpleasant scene, but most of it goes unseen.
And I think the power is in that suggestion that Refn can still manage to evoke the sense of violence without having to be deliberate on screen the way that Drive was, or something like Irreversible was, in terms of even Pan's Labyrinth, of showing an explicit act of violence on screen which evokes that reaction, that it can still evoke that reaction without that explicit on-screen sense of violence. That to me is a certain element of the power of the film.
Okay, thank you very much. A good point to end on. Only God Forgives opened a couple of weekends ago and is currently screening at the Arts Picture House. It is Certificate 18. Cambridge is no stranger to film and television productions, but the last fortnight has seen, tucked away in the hallways and libraries of St. John's and Girton Colleges, a film crew from India working on a period drama that offers an insight into how the homegrown audience for Indian cinema is changing and how the Indian film industry is changing to meet it. Written and directed by Shanu Rajeshkaran, I think I've got that just about right, Ramajujan tells the true story of Srinivasa Ramajujan, a mathematical genius born into poverty whose natural talent saw him secure a place at Trinity College. I spoke to the film's producers, who together, the four of them, have set up the Camphor Cinema, a new production company aiming to make Indian cinema with a global appeal that doesn't rely on the extravagance of Bollywood. I asked them about the current landscape of Indian cinema and how the rising middle classes are slowly changing the films Indian audiences want to watch. But I began by asking how the director had decided to take on this story.
This is Sindhu. I'm a co-producer and an assistant scriptwriter. I would like to first tell you about the director of the film, who's also the scriptwriter, and he's a national award-winning person whose films have gone to international film festivals and such. And he's made three biographies before. This is his fourth, and he read this one book about Ramanujan in Tamil. And what struck him most was that he died at such a young age, and he's such a genius. He is sort of like the rock star of the world of mathematics, but nobody in India knows about him. So this got him interested, and he started researching, reading more books about Ramanujan and such. And then everything about the story, what the director is looking for in the story is that, how does society handle a genius, you know, somebody who's abnormal? He was not understood by anybody in India, even his own family, although they supported him out of love. It was a very sad story. He never had any recognition that he deserved. And he was always trying to be understood in India. And then he sent his work to Professor Hardy in the UK. And then Professor Hardy obviously recognized his mathematical genius, because he's a self-taught mathematician. He did not have a normal course of, you know, how to prove a thing. He would basically just come up with the formula, and nobody understood that. So Professor Hardy saw that, and it struck him immediately that this is a genius. I need to get this person here to understand what he's up to.
I'm Sharanyan, co-producer of this movie.
The director has done a lot of research. He has almost spent 3 years of his life in doing research on this great mathematician. And he has visited his hometown, he has visited his college, he has visited his school. So a lot of hard work has gone into it. And all this pre-production, it started like almost one and a half years back. When we were sitting together and he said like, okay, this is the script, are you interested? And all the producers, we said, yes, let's get into it. So that's how it started.
Technically, this is an Indian movie which happens to be spoken in English. So the storyline is the same for the Tamil version and the English version, but the only difference is that in the Tamil version, everybody speaks in Tamil, and in the English version, people speak in English. So yeah, again, audiences would be Tamil version for the Tamil audiences, and the English version, we're also looking at the Indian audience, a larger Indian audience, because we have 26 languages spoken in India. So, you know, and as we were talking about the middle class, so most of them speak English and they prefer watching the English version. So we have a large audience in India itself for the English version, and we're also looking to release this in the UK and in other countries like the States. It follows the journey of Ramanujan, but we also have important other characters, his relationship with his mother, his relationship with Professor Hardy. So we're always constantly talking about how society treats this person.
My name's Kevin McGowan, and I'm playing Professor Hardy. I first became involved probably about 3 months ago. It was the story that I was interested in, a terribly sad story about somebody who was not appreciated in his own country at the time. And the prospect of trying to tell a story in Tamil was just something that was very exciting, and I couldn't really turn that down.
What has that experience been like as an actor?
There are various technical aspects to it that you always have to bear in mind. So you can't just, it's not like doing a play where you start and then you carry on. You have to maintain concentration. That's the biggest challenge, is while all the chaos is going around you, and the lights are moving and the set's being set up and the camera's moving, you have to maintain, okay, I'm in the English version and I'm doing it, and it'll stop, everything, a few things will change, and then you'll switch into the Tamil. It's maintaining the concentration. That's the biggest challenge.
Where does this film fit into the cinema landscape that India's currently enjoying?
In India, this film would not be Bollywood. In India, Bollywood does exist, but this film wouldn't be Bollywood. It would be, the Tamil version would be called Kollywood, because that's the Tamil-speaking audience. So as I said, Bollywood is what's known in the rest of the world because, you know, of the glamour and the budgets and things like that. So I wouldn't say it is a bad thing or a good thing to be called Bollywood, because, you know, but what happens is most times people associate Bollywood with glamour and you know, no storyline, basically. But our movie is nothing like that. So it's definitely not in that category. In the UK, I think ours would come under the indie film or the King's Speech. That's a good parallel. But I think that pigeonholing is very difficult to do with this sort of a movie.
With most areas of filmmaking, they have, especially when they're coming up, they have a new wave. Everybody knows the French New Wave, but there's a Czechoslovakian New Wave, a Polish New Wave, and a Romanian New Wave. Is India experiencing something like that? I'm not aware of it, or is it something that is happening?
That is happening, and our movie is... We are hoping that would become something like that, because as we talked about the middle class, when we say middle class, it's usually the young people. We're talking between the ages of 20 to 35. See, and they're exposed to a lot of things. They travel around the world. They watch a lot of international film, and they want to watch something meaningful, but something that entertains them at the same time. And that sort of thing is happening in India at the moment. And that's why we think it's a very good time for our film to release in India. You know, the English version especially, because people want to know such things, and they're very bored of those cliche films, and they want to watch these new films. It's all about taking these films to them.
Hi, my name is Sushant Desai, and I'm a co-producer for this film. I'd like to add here is basically the industry is getting more and more organized, and with the age of new filmmakers, what's been happening is, you know, as compared to the old filmmakers, the new filmmakers are actually, you know, have a more well-traveled, you know, done university in the West, or, you know, in the UK or the US or other parts of Europe, and worked there with collaborated with international artists and international crew and technicians, and then gone back to India and are now making films. At the same time, we have international crews now coming to India, working on Bollywood films. You know, there are different expertise, you know, from different parts of the world coming here. And, you know, when these borders are actually breaking down, that's when, you know, the new wave of era of filmmaking that's coming through in India, and you'd see in the next 5 to 10 years it's going to change completely. So the, you know, when branding of Bollywood is in my opinion going to just start reducing, and when you know movies are going just going to be cross border and probably just evergreen. You know, you can, anyone at any time can watch it at any place at any given point of time.
All four of us, all the four producers, Sushant, he has done his education from Edinburgh, Sindhu, she has done from Edinburgh, I have done my education from Aberdeen, Watson from US. So that's a kind of a culture that is building up back home, where people have that global experience and the tastes are changing a bit. So people want to experiment, people want to see new things, and I would say such kind of movie would be really appreciated by the audience.
Many thanks to Camphor Cinema and actor Kevin McGowan for allowing me on set and then finding a good 30 minutes to talk to me, especially when the interview wandered away from the film being produced in the background to concentrate on the state of Indian cinema. You can find out more about the continuing production of Ramajulian, they've moved down to London, by visiting the Camphor Cinema's website, which also has much more information on the production and the team behind it. It's at www.camphor, that's CAMPHOR, camphorcinema.com. You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio for your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Kevin Hilton, Gavin Midgley and Mark Liversidge. You've all kindly pointed out that I got Miss Havisham confused and it should have been Mrs. Danvers. Thank you. Chang and Only God Forgives reminded me of Mrs. Danvers and Godzilla. It's somehow reassuring that even in this day and age of superheroes and giant robots, there's still room for the traditional bickering adventure of the buddy cop movie. Two new releases, The Heat and Two Guns, take pride in the simplicity of this genre, with The Heat making itself noteworthy because it dares to make its argumentative leads female cops, played by Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy. Two Guns, meanwhile, stars Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg as DEA and naval agents who find themselves working the same case on the US-Mexican border. Both think the best way of bringing a drug cartel to court is to steal their savings, but are shocked to discover themselves holding $43 million rather than the small change in tax records they were expecting. Suddenly disowned by their own departments, the two find themselves on the run from just about every law enforcement agency in the US.
The bank was a setup. We gotta figure out whose money that was.
Well, like we're working together?
No, not like we're working.
Yeah!
No, like we're working in the same vicinity.
Together.
In the same area code.
Together.
He ripped off the CIA.
Where's the money?
It ain't down there, I can guarantee you that.
Some kind of way out of here.
You got 24 hours to bring me the money.
Send the Joker to the thief.
Yeah. So, partner, what's your plan?
I got a plan. I mean, I'm capable of coming up with a plan.
I'm not capable. I'm just saying you haven't told me. What is it?
I'm working on it. You're my people and there's a code.
You fight for the guy that's fighting next to you.
Give me the keys.
You want it? Come get him.
Oh, man! What was uncalled for?
Give me the keys.
You saw that move coming?
That's correct. Give me the keys.
Mark, we'll start with Two Guns, which opened yesterday. I suppose this is a film that works only as well as its leads, Washington and Wahlberg in this case. Do they make a watchable team?
They make a very watchable team. In fact, the film struggles slightly whenever they're not on screen together. They do riff so well of each other. I think a lot of the banter they have is improvised. They appear to have been given free rein by their Icelandic director. And whenever they're together, it really does feel like a very enjoyable throwback to the best buddy comedies of the 80s and 90s.
The problem is they're not together very often. I mean, they are together in the first act, which is in the third act, but there's a whole second act when they're apart working their own separate... finding out how they've been betrayed their own ways.
They are together two out of three acts. That's two thirds of a good film for a start.
Okay. Gavin, from the very first moment, even before the screens come up, and we've only got sound effects. This Two Guns, whilst I agree with Mark, it's good fun. It's trying a little bit too hard. It knows what it wants to be, and it's it's got that sort of... It opens with the train sound, with the level crossing bell, that sort of throaty roar of an American muscle car. You know which territory you're on even before you've seen an image. And then all that dialogue is supposed to have the spark of Walter Hill at his finest, of the sort of 48 hours. But it doesn't really spark. It feels like a sort of a carbon copy of a carbon copy.
I think it's probably being a bit harsh. It's good fun. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It is what it is, as they say. It has that sort of Walter Hill elements to it. As you say, it feels a bit like a latter-day Western in many ways, because it spends so much time out in the desert, and there's, you know, various interested parties all after the treasure or loot or whatever it is. You know, it has all the sort of ingredients of a Western. And it has a great cast as well. It's mostly a male-dominated cast, again, in the tradition of Walter Hill. So we've got two of my favourite actors, Bill Paxton and Fred Ward, who I both love to bits. And they both do really well, although Fred Ward's hardly in it. But you know,
and there's we'll a good James Olmos is the leader.
Yeah. And James Marsden is also great. And so there's... you're right in the sense that we've been here many, 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 many times before. But it's been a while since we've had a decent one of these. So I don't want to knock it too much. I did enjoy it. I think there's good chemistry between the leads. As Mark said, it's best when they're together and they're riffing on each other. And when it sort of fades into the explosions and the action set pieces, gets slightly less interesting. But
it is trying to have its cake and eat it a little bit, Mark. Final question before we move on to the heat. But it does have an interesting theme. It is not trying to say something. Again, this is not a film I want to say something, but it thinks it wants to say something. You have a sort of slow, meaningful scene when they have to cross the borders with the Mexican immigrants. Every US authority in this film, from the CIA to the DEA to the police, they're all untrustworthy or corrupt. There's nobody they can turn to. And there's one scene where Edward James Olmos, who I just said plays the Mexican drug cartel, says to Bill Paxton, the CIA agent, "You want to keep us corrupt and poor. You know, it's in your interests." So it sort of goes down that road, but not quite enough. In the end, it just... I'm happy with the film ending in a big gunfight, but it doesn't have the script to support the ideas it's interested in raising.
Yeah, I think a lot of the ideas are just left in the background to simmer gently rather than being brought to the forefront. It's odd in the way that it puts the money before the morality in a lot of senses, and that not only feels contemporary in terms of the relationship between that and the lack of any high-standing moral characters, but also feels very much a throwback to those 80s, 90s movies where, again, it was very simple goals that the characters were typically after. I defy anyone to remember most of it a week after seeing it, but it's great entertainment. It is what it is. It's not going to win any awards, but it's a lot of fun if you give it a chance.
If it stays in the head for a week, then it's doing better than most films.
Probably.
Kevin, we'll come on to the heat now. This, which has Melissa McCarthy, who everybody knows from Bridesmaids, and Sandra Bullock, who's been a fine comedian in Hollywood films for the past 20 or so years, and is a good dramatic actress as well. People forget that. But and this is the director of Bridesmaids and a writer, female writer, who's done Parks and Rec up to this point, Parks and Recreation. Again, it's playing an even more familiar game than Two Guns is, and again, does it relies on the two leads sparking? Do they? Is it worth seeing for those two that we know? So, you know, there's two familiar faces working together.
I think so. It does suffer from the sort of public image at the moment, post Bridesmaids, of Melissa McCarthy sort of just being this outrageous sort of character. And as good as that stuff is in the film, and it is, unfortunately, the bigger bulk of it, it does suffer also from her sort of just being her caricature just sort of unleashed. Sandra Bullock is, as you say, so good. She's such a professional actress at both sort of comedy and drama. This seems unfair. I mean, Melissa McCarthy really is sort of 80% of the movie, and Sandra Bullock is 20%. And you do watch a movie begging for more sort of a performance out of Sandra Bullock, for her role to have been given more... To be given the sort of space that Melissa McCarthy's sort of character is given. But it is enjoyable. I think comedy movies are probably the most overhyped sort of genre in mainstream, and when they come out, they're ultimately disappointing. It is actually a genuinely entertaining movie with genuine laughs in it. So, yeah, I think it's worth seeing.
Does it make the mistake, Mark? This is a rare occasion when I've not been able to see the film, but I was wondering if it made the mistake that I felt a film like The Other Guys made, which I find very funny in patches, where it actually takes the plot too seriously. It the other guys keep slowing down in order for the plot to swing into place so it can be a normal cops and robbers film when it's not being a Will Ferrell film. Does this make the same mistake, or is it just, you know, is the bad guy worthwhile opposing? Is it...
It oddly feels like almost a genuine police procedural, in the sense that they find loose ends. They're not particularly effective police officers for large chunks of it. It takes them an awful long while to uncover what's going on. In that sense, it probably is about 20 minutes too long. It's funny you mentioned the other guys. It did feel very reminiscent of that, that some of the best set pieces are very funny, but it's not funny enough consistently enough to really turn out to be a great movie. It's just a reasonable one in the final analysis.
Do they do anything with the game with them as because again, once this has been a big hit in America, it's a bit of counter programming. And every summer, where it's Mamma Mia or the Twilight films, Hollywood realizes it has a female audience or people who want to see a different sort of film, whether the female or whatever. And then it forgets the next summer and it's surprised again. But as you pointed out before we went on air, these aren't actually two very appealingly written female characters, as good as the actresses are portraying them.
No, it seems to want to go out of its way to make them as unlikable as possible. It's an odd choice, particularly when we finally, in the second decade of the 21st century, reached a point where we can have a buddy cop comedy with two female leads. I'm sure the suffragette movement would feel all their work 100 years ago was worthwhile, and it's taken us this long to get to that point. But does it manage to just rise above that particular selling point? A bit, but not much.
Okay. All right. Well, both Two Guns and The Heat are still on general release. The Heat has got some late night screenings. It's vanishing quite quickly. Both are screening at View and Cineworld cinemas, and both are certificate 15.
Cambridge has a vibrant food and drink scene. On Flavour, we talk with a wide range of food and drink producers. We visit cafes, restaurants, pubs, and independent food stores. We find out what's new and what's good. We review the food items in the papers. If it's about food and drink, if it's local and good, it's on Flavour. Alternate Saturdays, 12 till 1, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
You're online, so are we. Search for Cambridge 105 on Facebook and Twitter, or follow the links from our website, cambridge105.fm.
Every second Sunday of the month, tune in to Cambridge 105 for Our Mill Road at 9 p.m. with me, Kerry Anne Child. I'll be covering the latest news and events from Cambridge's most cosmopolitan street here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
And don't forget that Our Mill Road has moved from its Sunday slot, as advertised in the ad we just heard, to Saturday afternoons between 2 and 3, followed by Radio Dante, and then from 4 p.m, the new 105 Sports Show, which today has the latest from the Aldershot versus Cambridge United match, plus all the news and discussions from the opening day of the Premier League. Is it football season already? Football season already. The World Championships and the 2020 Finals Day. The last few years have seen a rise of the outdoor cinema. Once simply the preserve of the rough-and-ready Midwestern American drive-in, the Al Fresco Flea Pit now has a luster of luxury. It parks in elaborate locations and finds itself sponsored by brands such as Samsung and Haagen-Dazs. But the Cambridge Film Trust got there first. They've been running an increasingly ambitious and imaginative series of outdoor screenings for the past decade, reaching their apogee with the films shown in the lead-up to the annual Cambridge Film Festival. In the first of a series of pieces we're broadcasting the highlight next month's 33rd Cambridge Film Festival, I spoke to Vicky Fenton, the festival's marketing and sponsorship manager, as well as Jack Toy from the Arts Picture House, about this summer's upcoming screenings, the films being shown and the magical locations they're being shown in. But I began by asking how, in the past few years, the popularity of the outdoor screenings has changed.
It's very enjoyable to go to an outdoor cinema event, and I think once you've been to one, then you want to go to more, and it fires up a bit of an appetite for it. The audience is very wide. It's not just people that would normally think they love cinema, but like the experience of going and sitting outside somewhere, having a picnic and with friends and making a real night of it. And certainly over the last few years, more and more outdoor cinema venues and companies are starting up events. And I think it's just generating this kind of market for a really great cinematic experience. And our outdoor cinema program has grown this year to meet the demands for it.
Could you go through some of the new venues you have for this year, and before we go into the venues that are familiar, like Grantchester, for instance?
We've got some film nights on Fridays coming up at the Red Lion in Whittlesford on the 23rd of August and the 6th of September. We're really excited to be showing films at the Jockey Club Rooms in Newmarket this year. It's a venue that's normally closed to the public, really historical, beautiful place on the lawns there. We'll be showing films three nights in a row on the 29th to the 31st. And also Childerley Hall for the first time, very beautiful setting. And we'll be showing Edward Scissorhands there. There are beautiful grounds full of topiary, so it's very fitting. And that's on the 14th of September. So we're very excited to be screening a film there too. I think really we find venues by our festival director, Tony Jones, just being so excited about outdoor cinema and travelling around and deciding that it would be great if we have an outdoor film event somewhere and then contacting them. That seems to be what happens.
Could you explain a little bit about the Grantchester screenings, which have been running for many, many years now, and especially this year, the form they're taking with the double screenings? You can see either Life of Pi or Moo Man. I'm interested in how those double screenings are working and possibly the idea behind them.
We like to say that we're multiplexing Grantchester Meadows. We're going to have the screens at right angles to each other. And Life of Pi is obviously a big blockbuster, as we've spoken about. It won 4 Oscars, but we have got the Moo Man in there as well. So we have got a kind of independent film showing that people would be interested in. And on the Sunday night, we have Singing in the Rain, or you can choose the Jungle Book to watch so kids can come along, hopefully, and enjoy that. And kids are actually free for the first time this year at Grantchester Meadows, which we're quite excited about.
My name is Jack Toy and I am the marketing manager at the Arts Picture House and the events assistant at the Cambridge Film Trust. Grantchester is the pinnacle, the apotheosis of setting up outdoor events because it's our biggest blow-up screen and it's on the other side of a little river, which is challenging to get everything over there. We have to drive our van down a little dirt track on the other side of the river, carefully unload everything, and then we assemble a kind of rope and dinghy operation to get us across the river where our projection gear is. And we also have to be very considerate with that job because we've got neighbours around Grantchester that don't necessarily want to be listening to the films we're screening. So we have a silent disco-esque approach where everyone has headphones and they can tune in to either film A or film B. And so that requires a radio transmitter on our projection box. And so that is about the most technical setup we do. But it's not necessarily most challenging because, for instance, we had a screening of Barry Lyndon in Brighton's Royal Pavilion last November with a very small 12x7 pop-up screen, just a metal frame. But it was in this amazing room with priceless chandeliers and an expensive carpet and mirrors that we could smash. And so when you're putting up a 12x7 screen with a chandelier dangling just above it, that's where your heart gets racing and you've got to be really careful you don't break anything. Which we didn't, I should say. It all went well.
So is the environment that these films screen in, it's almost 3D in a way. You're offering an environment that echoes film's themes or the film's location or situation.
Yeah, the content and the environment are programmed to match by Tony a lot of the time. So perfect example of that would be the Jesus screen Lido. Last year we had Jaws on two screens and this year we've got Finding Nemo, which hopefully we're going to be doing in 3D, which should be very exciting.
A lot of the films we show are old classics, and we've often done some like It Hot. We've got that again at the Red Lion. And obviously we've got Singing in the Rain on Grantchester Meadows. I think we do choose classics so people know that they're going to enjoy the film rather than go to a big event like that and make a big night of it and then be disappointed that the film, you know, won't be something that they were looking for. And we're also just wanting to have a really broad appeal to attract lots of people to come to these events.
Sticking with the Grantchester screenings, which are the first main screenings coming up before the festival, how do they go about? What time do you turn up? What time do the screenings start?
The films start at dusk, basically. When the sun starts to go down, you can see the screen with the film on, so we have to wait till then, which is about 8 to 8.30. You can arrive any time from 6 p.m. onwards and have a little explore around Grantchester Meadows. There will be a few food stalls there. I've got Black Bull with their award-winning pies and some other ones. Or you can bring a picnic and enjoy having a chat with friends sitting by the river before the film comes on. The films are watched through a radio mic, so you can flick between the channels and choose which film you want to watch. We ask that you bring your own headphones, but we do have some to borrow as well. And the tickets for Grantchester Meadows are £12 for adults, £10 concessions, which is Arts Picture House members, students and OAPs, and tickets are available at www.camfilmfest.com.
Many thanks to Vicky Fenton and Jack Toy for sitting down for the interview. To reiterate the times and locations of the outdoor screenings, Some Like It Hot is at the Red Lion in Whittlesford on the 23rd of August, whilst the Grantchester screenings kick off on Saturday the 24th of August with Life of Pi and Moo Man. And Sunday the 25th is when to head down to Grantchester if you wish to see Singing in the Rain or The Jungle Book. There is more information at www.cambridgefilmfestival.org. Plus, there'll be chances to win a pair of tickets for many of the outdoor screenings if you tune in to either 105 Breakfast or 105 Drive over the next couple of weeks. More details will soon be available on the Cambridge 105 website, www.cambridge105.fm. The last major blockbuster of the summer season, The Lone Ranger, has been a contentious film from the start. A passion project for its star Johnny Depp, it revives the Wild West hero of a 1930s pulp radio serial, with Depp as the Native American sidekick and the whole thing wrapped up in the theme park style of Pirates of the Caribbean director Gore Verbinski. Armie Hammer plays John Reed, the book-smart brother to a legendary and fearless Texas Ranger. When the psychopathic, cannibalistic outlaw Butch Cavendish murders his brother and leaves him for dead in the desert, Reed is saved by the mysterious Tonto. A Comanche Indian, played by Depp in a deadpan performance that oddly echoes Buster Keaton, Tonto is looking for revenge against the bloodthirsty Cavendish. He convinces Reed to don a mask to hide his identity, and together the two set out to bring Cavendish and his gang to justice.
Eight men rode into canyons. I dug seven graves. The men you seek think you are dead. Better to stay that way.
You want me to wear a mask?
Justice is what a man must take for himself.
It was a ranger
riding a white horse.
Got some lunatic Indian with him.
They come for you.
If these men represent the law, I'd rather be an outlaw.
He's coming for you.
Let him go!
Gavin, word on mouth on The Lone Ranger was poisonous before release. The budget was huge. There were werewolves involved. Disney took it, wanted it rewritten. There were werewolves in the original script.
Really? Yes, I'm impressed.
And it's been word of mouth has barely been any less poisonous since release, certainly in America. Is it really a film that, with this cast, with this director, that deserves such derision?
Emphatically not. No. This is, for me, this is the film of the summer. I had so much fun, and it was, it's 2.5 hours, for a start, it's 2.5 hours long. I can see why it caught so much flack from American reviewers. They've clearly got fed up with Johnny Depp, mincing around in his sort of Jack Sparrow way. They've clearly had enough of Gore Verbinski making films, summer blockbusters, that are too long and too overstuffed with, action and spectacle and special effects, and it's too long. 2.5 hours, they've decided is 2 hours. Is too long. 2 hours, maybe not 2 hours too long, but just too long.
Have generally. You got anything positive to say?
Yeah. I'm coming to that. This 2.5 hours flies by. It absolutely flies by. And it's just so much fun. I hate it when reviewers draw comparisons to Raiders of the Lost Ark, because it's such a lazy, lazy comparison. But for me, it's actually quite a pertinent thing, because it does exactly what Raiders of the Lost Ark does, which is to resurrect the sort of Saturday morning, Saturday matinee serial adventures, but make them relevant, make them fun to a modern audience, while sort of goofing it up a little bit as well, just slightly tongue-in-cheek, but respectfully. Respectfully treats its characters and its origins and the action, and it just gets the balance absolutely right. So there's plenty of action, there's plenty of fun, you know, the humour. I mean, Johnny Depp is terrific as Tonto, Armie Hammer is terrific as the Lone Ranger as well, and they have a good chemistry there, playing off each other quite nicely. And it doesn't turn into the Johnny Depp show, which it quite easily could have done, given that it was Johnny Depp who was the driving force, as you said, behind getting this film up and running. It's, if you know anything about cinema at all, it's great fun because you can sort of tick off the references to various other westerns. We've got lots of Sergio Leone in there, Once Upon a Time in the West, Good, the Bad and the Ugly, as well as some more classic ones. And you already mentioned Buster Keaton, of course. And that's the treasure, that's the gold nugget in this film, is the sort of 10-15 minute finale, which pays tribute to the general. Buster Keaton's the general. And it could almost have been a silent cinema film short in its own right. And I was just sitting there with a huge smile on my face. And I couldn't understand why are people not enjoying this? It's been terribly marketed, absolutely terribly marketed by Disney. They really should be shot. I don't know.
It's the same team as John Carter.
clearly, yeah, which is another one. But it gets it right in the way that... do you remember the Green Hornet from
a couple of years
ago? Yeah, exactly, which got it completely wrong. This is a textbook example of how to treat pulp material right and get it, but respectfully and entertainingly. I loved it.
Mark, you weren't quite as convinced, but you're not a negative Nelly either.
No, I mean, there are a few problems. There's a framing device which features a very old Tonto.
Oh, that's heartbreakingly sad, though.
It is, but it feels to me just a little too Princess Bride. It doesn't quite add as much as something like the Princess Bride cutaways do. The score sits a little uneasily. Hans Zimmer's score is great. The William Tell overture, Rossini, is iconic. They never quite sit as comfortably as I'd like them to. It feels slightly too much of a jump. I don't think Hans Zimmer's blended that into his score as well. However, when you do get to the points, and there's two or three in the film, when the March of the Swiss Soldiers kicks in, it's fantastic. Your pulse starts racing. Those are the moments that really energise the film. I think if you'd been able to do something better with the framing device, cut out a little of the dead weight in the middle, which is possibly centred around the fact that the film is trying to have its cake and eat it in the sense of having cartoon Indians and genuine Indians. And that never quite gels either. I think if you could have rectified a few of those, it would have been an out-and-out success. And I think if the marketing team had known what to do with it as well, it would have soared. To me, the easy comparisons to the Pirates movies, I think it's as good as any except the first Pirates movie. If you're willing to give it a chance, there's a lot of fun to be had.
Kevin, in the end, the problems this has, and it's a little bit bloated, it's thematically a little bit confused here and there, it's unbalanced, but those aren't problems that we don't get with almost every summer blockbuster. And what came across to me anyway, and I didn't enjoy it as much as Gavin, but it is, it's an odd word to use, the sincerity of it. It felt like it was trying to give the audience as good a time, and it wasn't doing it in a cynical way like the Transformers films.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I disagreed with what you were saying about the wraparound. I actually really like the wraparound story with
this is the elderly Tonto in San Francisco's being built, telling the story. Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was odd that he should sort of be standing there as sort of a live mannequin. But other than that, I thought it was really nice. And I think and I know you're going to hate this, but I think it did at best, in its best moments, was sort of like Spielberg's finest sort of things in Raiders of the Lost Ark. At its worst, it is like the worst elements in Pirates of the Caribbean. I do think it is probably about half hour, 45 minutes too long. Suffers unbearably from a sense of they catch up to the bad guys and then they just lose them. Mm. They catch up with them and then they just lose them again. But yeah, I think it was sincere. And I think one of the things I read was that it knocks off lots of other westerns, and it's sort of unashamedly so. I actually thought it was a really nice, sincere tribute to a lot of westerns and western cinema, and having Monument Valley and the old sort of music motif, and I thought it was a genuine
especially when these things are in a $250 million blockbuster that's meant to that. It's quite, not just in terms of for a film that's cost that much money and then has that much has that much investment put into it and has these big stars that have delivered before, it's actually fairly subversive, not just in simply the fact it's cramming in as many obscure references to a genre that nobody sees any longer at the cinema, but also in the fact that the capitalism is the bad guy here. I'm simplifying that, but the railway is the bad guy. And even at the end, Armie Hammer decides, the Lone Ranger decides, I'm not going to trust you. And he has to step outside the law in order to, which, you know, it doesn't, and it actually mocks the American anthem in one scene where it's actually the background to illegal goings on. I thought that was quite, in that way, it was quite subversive. It was interestingly subversive, minorly. Like obviously, it's minor subversive. I enjoyed Johnny Depp. I thought I don't know quite. I think the critics are being lazy in the way they're criticizing him in the typical way critics are lazy. This is a different performance from than Jack Sparrow. This is a much more, not just simply deadpan, but it's a lot quieter and it's
more emotional as well. I think. I mean, there is possibly one of the faults of the film is that everything has to have a backstory and everyone has to have a complete arc, and it does have that slightly overstuffed feeling, certainly. But Chanté's character is incredibly much more fleshed out. I mean, that's one of the great things it's done with it. It's taken one of the sort of cheap, nasty, stereotypical sort of images of Native Americans.
They've made him the hero. It's made him the hero exactly, of the film, and yeah. it, without really lessening the Lone Ranger himself. Mocks him a little bit, but doesn't. He's not a buffoon.
No, exactly, yeah. And he does share that screen time, whereas the, you know, John Reed character is much more straightforward in that sense. He has to play the sort of straight guy to Johnny Depp, but they work well together. And it resurrects all these sort of Western tropes for a new audience. I mean, as you say, trying to get a multi-million dollar blockbuster Western into multiplexes is an incredibly difficult proposition these days. I mean, look at the Wild Wild West and other sort of casualties that have tried to do that before.
I think it's worthwhile pointing out again, we're all in agreement in here, that the 20-minute finale is just spectacular, but not in a typical, obviously it's filled with special effects, but the way the William Cello Overture is used, the way it's cut to the sound, it is almost, it's unlike, for that reason, for the execution of it, it's something like something we've seen in summer blockbusters for a very long time.
Best things I've seen in a long time.
I think that's true. All right.
The one thing that struck me slightly odd is that this is Gore Verbinski's second go at a Johnny Depp Western full of references, and actually the first one, Rango, I felt worked slightly better. It was tighter, more focused, and delivered a more consistent story. It's a shame they couldn't quite repeat the success of that.
But and it has more of a story as well, being based on Chinatown, whilst the Lone Ranger is pretty much the Mask of Zorro all over again. It's the same plot. Okay, the Lone Ranger, which we all recommend, it opened a week ago and is currently screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. That is all we have time for on the show today. The past hour will be made available around midweek as a Cambridge 105 podcast. You can hear me at your leisure, mispronouncing Indian names. We'll be back on Saturday the 31st of August with a show looking at Bodybuilders with Pain and Gain, Class War with Elysium, and Blue Movies with Lovelace, the Deep Throat biography. Plus, we'll have the second of our pieces looking forward to the Cambridge Film Festival. We'll round up proceedings with Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly singing and tap dancing their way through Moses Supposes, from the soundtrack to Singing in the Rain, which is screening as part of the Grantchester Meadows outdoor screenings on Sunday, the 24th of August. But from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
But Moses, he noses, his toeses aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toeses to be.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously.
A mose is a mose.
A rose is a rose.
A toes is a toes.
Hoop-de-doody-doodle.
Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. For Moses, he noses, his toeses aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toeses to be. Moses supposes his toes are roses. 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 Moses supposes his